Today we're going to take a virtual tour of Mount Herzl, which is the equivalent for Israel of Arlington Military Cemetery. But rather than focusing so much on the deaths of people, I think it's an amazing place to speak about because it talks very much about what these people stood for and makes us think about our own lives. What are we living for today? What are we willing to die for? And what do we feel we would do in our moments of choice that are comparable to what these people had to deal with? So I'd like to begin. I want you all to notice these were done by my two daughters. So my daughter, 10-year-old, asked me this morning, "Mommy, did you show the PowerPoint yet?" I said, "No, in 3.5 hours." So now we can all tell her that hopefully you'll like the job that she did. Now, Herzl Cemetery is named for Theodor Herzl, who was a Hungarian, totally assimilated Jew, who became a newspaper reporter in Paris. And in 1895, when he saw the aftermath of the Dreyfus Affair, and the French people were shouting, "Death to the Jews," sound a little familiar? It awakened his Jewish consciousness. And he decided that he wanted to do something to try to create a Jewish state and to mobilize the world to give the Jews their homeland. This is Alfred Dreyfus, for those of you who don't know what the affair was. Alfred Dreyfus was an officer in the French army. He was framed by an anti-Semite. He was stripped of his all of his medals. He was publicly defamed, and he was sent to Devil's Island. At the end of a number of years, he was finally let go, and he was pardoned, but it was a very horrific experience. Okay, here's Mount Herzl Cemetery. Herzl asked that he be buried in the grave next to his father. He actually passed away in 1897 of heart failure at the age of 44. He had spent his life trying to campaign for worldwide support for the Jewish state. And he asked, he believed in 50 years the Jews would have their homeland. He died in 97, excuse me, he proclaimed in 97 that in 50 years they'd have their homeland. 1947 is when the UN did proclaim that Israel should have a homeland for the Jewish people. And he asked that his remains be buried in Israel when the Jews had their state. And that's exactly what happened. That's his grave in the upper right. It simply says on it, Herzl. Now, in 1860, Moses Montefiore began the first modern Jewish settlement in Jerusalem outside the Old City. From 1860 until 1948, there were numerous attacks by Arabs on Jews. Many Jews were murdered. From 1948 until, this does not include the war in Gaza, this was made up in about December, this is how many Jews were killed. 22,437 Jews were killed for being Jewish in the land of Israel. We're going to hear about some of these people today. So now we're going to walk over to the section. One sec, what happened here? Okay. Now we're going to talk about how Israel as a modern state was created. In 1947, November 29th, the UN decided that they were going to vote on Israel becoming a homeland for the Jewish people. If you want to read about what happened in the background, read John Loftus's book, The Secret War Against the Jews, and why the UN did approve the state. Fascinating story. But in any case, the British had had Israel from 1917 until 1948. During those 31 years, they decided to give away this land that supposedly they were there to give only to the Jewish people. They first gave away 80% to the Hashemite kingdom, which became Jordan. Of the 20% that was left, the UN gave roughly half to the Jews and the other half to the Arabs, giving away a total of 90% of the land of Palestine to the Arabs. The UN voted November 29th to give the Jews their country. The next day, the Arabs attacked. There were bloody wars going on all around Israel. One of the first moves the Arabs made was to besiege Jerusalem. Now, in all of Israel at that time, there were 600,000 Jews. Jerusalem had 1/6 of the country's population. The Arabs knew that if they could get Jerusalem to fall, the rest of Israel would fall with it. So after they besieged Jerusalem, the only way to bring food and water and medical supplies into the city, Israel had no planes, by the way, was to bring them up by convoys up a very difficult pass between two mountains, going up a long, long hill up into the city. The Jews who made these convoys were going on suicide missions. 90% of them did not make it. In the War of Independence, which actually started in 1947 with these attacks, 6,000 Jews were killed. That's 1% of the entire population of the Jewish state was killed. Most of them were killed trying to bring supplies into Jerusalem and capture the city and break the siege on the city. One of the many miracles of the war of 1948 was that 2 days before Jerusalem was going to run out of food and water, they found an alternate route to bring supplies into the city, and it was literally just in the nick of time. During this time of siege, by the way, the Jews were able to have only about 3 or 4 slices of bread per person per day, and people resorted to eating weeds to keep alive. Okay, so this was the War of Independence, and after the War of Independence, 300 Jews who were killed in Arab territory were left among the Arabs. The Jews wanted to bring them to Israel for Jewish burial, and that is how Mount Herzl was created. Over here we see a depiction of some of the battles that went on in the War of Independence. The one in the middle is the claiming of Eilat. That's a very famous story. And you see some of the people who fought in the war. These are two people who got who died in Har Adar. This Har Adar was the place that the British had had, and it was a high point overlooking the valley where many Jews were killed trying to relieve the siege of Jerusalem. If you look at the gravestones, you'll see one on the right is 16 years old. The one on the left is 19 years old. There are many, many battles of people who tried to help the siege of Jerusalem. It was decided to bury these 300 Jews in Jerusalem because it was felt that every Jew who fell fighting for the state of Israel was really fighting to defend eternal Jerusalem for the Jewish people. Most of the stones in the army section indicate where these people came from, their age, when they made Aliyah, and when they died. The immigrants who fought in the War of Independence came from all over the world. And when they were buried here, each person in the cemetery was laid to rest with his feet facing the Temple Mount so that at the time of resurrection, they'll be facing the holiest place in the world. We see here the grave of Almoni. Almoni is anonymous. How is it possible that these soldiers were anonymous? Well, there is a grave, for example, that also says only Yisrael Amir. These people died trying to relieve the Arab siege on the road to Jerusalem. The tombstones are stark and hardly worded with anything. It simply says he fell in the Battle of Jerusalem. He was brought to rest here on the 16th of the month of Adar, in the year 1948. May he rest, may his soul rest in the souls of the righteous. This is the equivalent of Washington's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. These people probably knew no Hebrew, and very few people knew them. Therefore, they were anonymous. We don't know who their parents were, where they were born, or when they made Aliyah. We don't even know how old they were. These people survived the European death camps by sheer determination to come to their home in the land of Israel to fight for Jerusalem. They got off the European refugee boats. They were given a rifle, but no instructions as to how to operate them. They didn't even know how to open the safety catch before they were sent to battle. These refugees spoke only Yiddish, and their commanders spoke only Hebrew. These men were killed in battle soon after they came to the land of Israel, often within days. These people are watched over by the cypress trees that resemble yahrzeit candles. These men lie among their comrades with fragrant rosemary adorning their graves as they await the future resurrection of the dead. Here we have the grave of Zohara Levitov. Zohara was a very interesting woman. She joined the Palmach, which was the elite defense arm of the Haganah, the Jewish defense forces that was begun in 1941. From then until the incorporation of the Palmach into the IDF in 1949, 1,169 Palmachniks were killed. One of the trainers of these brave men and young women also developed explosives for the Israeli army. His story was a fascinating one. He was a chemistry major in college, and Ben-Gurion asked him to develop explosives for a country that had nothing. He used to go to the chemist in the old city very near my house and ask him for common chemicals because he didn't even have that to make explosives with. When the pharmacist asked him, "What can you give me to pay for these supplies?" he said, "Absolutely nothing." They all agreed that when they would have a steak, they would work out the deal, and I'm sure it never happened. In any case, Ori Bachrov, who is now in his 80s, is one of my neighbors. He's a very vibrant man, and he has albums of how he used to train these Palmachniks to fight in these wars that they anticipated. In any event, Zohara met her boyfriend, Shmuel Kaufman, in the Palmach. They got engaged thinking, we've given enough of our lives, enough contributions to the Palmach, we want to go get married, and we want to study abroad. Zohara wanted to study medicine. And on their last day in the Palmach, which was in 1947, a grenade blew up in Shmuel's face, and he died. Zohara decided to go to the United States to go study. And While she went there initially to study medicine, her parents thought she was going to be in a safe place. When the war broke out in 1948, she decided to take a pilot's course in the United States. Israel's Air Force, by the way, began with two old jet planes. That was the entire Air Force. And she took a pilot's course and came back to Israel to help the Jews. When the Jews in Jerusalem were besieged during the war again in 1948, Zahara flew a mission over to bring food and supplies to the Jews in the city of Jerusalem. Leaving the city in her plane, the plane crashed and killed Zahara. Very sadly, Zahara was not the only member that her parents lost. She was the third child of her parents to die. There was such a great need for fighters in 1948 that 20% of the Givati Brigade were women. We now walk over to the issue of parachutists. You'll notice that the design looks like a parachute itself, the letter V, also the V for victory. These parachutists were recent immigrants to Palestine from countries that the British wanted to infiltrate. The British trained these men and women and then dropped them from behind enemy lines between May of 1943 and the end of World War II. Palestine at that time was under the British mandate. The British were spending £100 million a year between 1948 to keep the Jews out of Israel. They brought 100,000 British soldiers and other staff to keep the Jews out of our homeland. This is at a time when they were rationing bread in London. So nevertheless, the British had their own reasons. They wanted these parachutists to go abroad. And they decided that maybe the British could have these people become wireless operators and instructors of British liaison missions to partisans and to locate and rescue Allied POWs and escapees. Out of an initial 240 volunteers, only 29 men and 3 women actually went on these missions to Europe. Sadly, 12 were captured and 7 were executed, including Haviva Reich in Slovakia and Hanna Senes in Hungary. I'm sure many of you know who those people are. We're going to see a little bit more about Haviva Reich. This is her tomb, and these are pictures of Haviva. Haviva was born in Slovakia. She joined a communist secular Jewish youth group there and immigrated to Palestine when she was 25. Her first move was to join the Palmach, and she went to Italy in 1944, hoping to infiltrate Slovakia and help them fight the Axis powers. When the British refused to send women behind enemy lines, she hitched a ride with some American pilots and joined her fellow parachutists. In the month before they were captured by the Ukrainian SS, Haviva and 4 others organized a soup kitchen and community center for refugees and helped Jewish children to escape to Hungary and from there to Palestine. They also used their connections with partisan and resistance groups to help the Allied POWs. And in the end, the Germans shot these people that the Ukrainians had captured, including Haviva. Her remains were brought to Mount Herzl in 1952. Hanna Senes was born to an assimilated Jewish family in Budapest in 1921. She was enrolled in a Protestant private school where she was charged triple what the other students paid because she was a Jew. That got her so angry, plus realizing that Hungarian Jews were in danger, that she decided to identify as a Jew and join a Zionist student organization. When she was 18, she immigrated to Palestine and joined Kibbutz Sedot Yam in the Haganah. In March of 44, she and 2 male parachutists were dropped into Yugoslavia. The men understood that the mission was too dangerous to continue, and they didn't do so. But she continued to the Hungarian border, where she was almost immediately arrested. She was tortured mercilessly for days, and they finally said to her, "If you don't tell us what we want to know about where the other parachutists are, we're going to torture your mother as well." Haviva, as Hanna, revealed absolutely nothing, but she was imprisoned for 7 months. During the time she was in jail, she used a mirror to flash signals to the Jewish prisoners in other cells and communicated with them using large cutout letters in Hebrew from her window of the prison. She even tried to keep up the other people's spirits by singing in prison. She was tried for treason and was executed at age 23. She referred to herself as a match and wrote many poems which became models for Israelis of how to become valorous soldiers. Her match was snuffed out, but her sacrifice encouraged others because she and her comrades were willing to take a 1 in a million chance to save Jews anywhere in the world. Her bones were moved to Mount Herzl in 1950, and she was finally exonerated by the Hungarian government in 1993. There are people who say that these 7 parachutists failed in their mission because all were captured and executed. But that isn't exactly true. They gave Jews during and after the Holocaust, who were starving and hunted, devastated and hopeless, broken in body and soul, reason to live, to fight, and to escape. Enzo Sereni was a secular Italian Jew whose father was the physician to the King of Italy. In May of 1944, Enzo parachuted into northern Italy, but was captured immediately and sent to Dachau. An inmate who expected to be exterminated any day, with no strength or will to resist, had the following conversation with Sereni. "Where are you from?" "I'm from Palestine, from Eretz Yisrael," Sereni said. "What? I thought there were no Jews left anywhere in the world anymore. Certainly not in Israel." Sereni replied, "Yes, yes, we are building and defending the land, and in 3 years we're going to have a state." The inmate was so energized by their conversation, he took heart, he escaped from Dachau, and he joined the partisans, and eventually, after the war, made it to the land of Israel. Sereni, unfortunately, was shot to death 6 months later. These seven brave volunteers failed in their mission to meet underground forces in Nazi-occupied Europe, but they succeeded beyond all expectations in inspiring doomed Jews who were starved and hunted, who had lost all hope. Who would come to their aid? The Palestinian Jewish fighters, uniformed and armed, showed them that they were not forgotten and that the Jewish people were still alive. Can we imagine their bravery at a time in Jewish history when so much dread and angst was befalling the Jewish people? Here's someone I'm sure you're going to recognize. Ariel Scheinerman was a history student in 1948. His teacher asked him, "Do you want to learn about history or do you want to make it?" Scheinerman changed his name to Sharon and joined the Haganah and became the head of the Alexandroni Brigade after only 4.5 months. Together with the 30 men who fought with him, they created the first paratrooper unit. It's hard to have paratroopers when you didn't have airplanes. Such units didn't exist until they created this one. So many Jews were idealistic then. They asked, "How can I help a cause that is greater than myself?" Unfortunately, things have changed very much today. I made Aliyah with my family in 2002 at the height of the Intifada, when after planning for 10 years to make Aliyah, the Intifada was completely out of control. I was afraid of taking our children to Israel amidst all of the terror attacks. My husband, who had to go kicking and screaming to Israel, turned around that day and said to me, "You have dreamed of moving to Israel for more than 10 years. It's easy to make Aliyah when things are comfortable, but it's so much more meaningful when times are difficult." A friend who had made Aliyah 10 years before us said, "We had a choice to read history or to make history. We decided to leave the United States to live history." 1956 was Mitzvah Kadesh, or the Sinai Campaign. After the War of Independence, the UN asked Israel to make painful concessions to the Arabs to achieve a lasting peace. The Israelis did. The same day, an Arab murdered a Jew, and that was the beginning of many following acts of violence. Between 49, when the truce was drawn up, and 1956, Egyptian soldiers and Arab terrorists killed 101 Israelis in nearly 2,000 armed clashes with Israel. September 55, Egypt violated international agreements and blocked Israel from trading with much of Africa and the Far East. The following year, Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, which was mostly owned by Britain and France. They and Israel responded with the Sinai Campaign in October 1956. In the end, 231 Israeli soldiers were killed during a mere 8 days of fighting. 4.5 months later, the UN sent 3,300 troops to replace Israeli troops and guarantee them security for the rest of the time. Israel got international assurances that the Sinai and Gaza Strip would be quiet and she could access the Suez Canal. As soon as the Israelis left, the Egyptians refused to open the Suez Canal to Israeli shipping. This is the Mitla Pass, one of the very famous battles in the Sinai Campaign. When Israeli forces arrived at the Mitla Pass in Sinai, they didn't know where the Egyptians were. No one was willing to volunteer to drive through the pass to find out where the enemy was. So, uncharacteristically, the commander appointed Yehuda Kondror to drive his jeep through the Mitla Pass on a suicide mission. Egyptian fire severely wounded him, and after what seemed to be an almost miraculous recovery, this 21-year-old man, who's shown here in the picture with his sister Shula, succumbed to his wounds at Hadassah Hospital. Thanks to his astonishing courage, Israel was able to destroy the now-revealed Egyptian strongholds. His older brother was killed at Castel in another battle of Jerusalem, and his parents asked Yehuda to leave before he was killed because he was in a paratrooper unit. They figured he would be much safer as a driver, and he also was killed. His parents lost both of their sons. In this area is also Oved Leshinsky, who threw himself on a grenade to save his comrades, and Yaakov Shafferman, whose grenade top pulled out in a plane. He fell in it also to protect those nearby during the Sinai campaign. Mount Herzl makes a person wonder, why does someone decide to do something heroic, to sacrifice oneself for others? It's Jewish to be a soldier. It's extraordinary to fall on a grenade to save those around you. No one teaches a soldier to do such things. Can one be a hero without making a life and death decision? What inspires these kinds of decisions to be made? When former President George Bush visited Yad Vashem last year, he said that true heroism is holding on to your faith and ideals when there is horror all around you. We now see those who fell in the first Lebanon war called Peace for Galilee in 1982. In 1981, Arab terrorists in South Lebanon shot Katyusha rockets at Israeli settlements. After a ceasefire was declared that July, Arabs kept attacking Israelis in the northern towns and abroad. The IDF then launched Operation Peace for Galilee in June of 82. The conventional war lasted until August 23rd, when Israeli forces surrounded and bombarded the PLO and Syrian forces in Beirut. International peacekeepers helped these terrorists safely leave Lebanon. During the next 3 years, Israeli soldiers went into Beirut, destroyed the Syrian Air Force in the Bekaa Valley, and tried to prevent terrorism. After a peace treaty was attempted, Lebanese Muslims made daily ambushes against Israeli soldiers in Lebanon, killing 1,216 men between June 82 and May of 1985, in 3 years' time. Israel finally withdrew to a narrow security strip, and this entire war divided the entire country and led to the resignation of Menachem Begin. During this war, there was a very tragic story. There were two Harel families who lived in the Jerusalem community of Armon HaNetziv, about a mile and a half from my house. Each had a 20-year-old son in the army, but neither knew of the other. During the first Lebanon war, officers told the family of Yuval Harel number one the devastating news that he had been killed in battle. 12 hours later, as the family was sitting Shiva, army messengers came to the family and said, "We made a mistake. It wasn't your son Yuval who was killed, but Yuval Harel down the street who was killed." And they told that family that their son had indeed died, and they buried their son and went to sit Shiva. Unbelievably, 2 days later, the army came back to the family of Yuval number one again with the tragic news that their son had indeed been killed this time. These two boys lie side by side, three graves apart in Mount Herzl. There was once a genius of a rabbi in Vilna named Rav Gustman. One day, Rav Gustman stood in line as Nazis shot his neighbors one by one. As soon as they shot his son, a plane flew overhead and the Nazis scattered. He was next in line, but he hid among the corpses. After the Nazis left him for dead, he hid in forests and caves and even in pig pens, and eventually joined the partisans in Europe who fought the Nazis. Years later, the Lubavitcher Rebbe convinced him to open a small yeshiva in Jerusalem. On Thursdays at noon, the study hall opened to the public at large, and it filled to capacity with rabbis and intellectuals, religious court judges, and professors. When Rav Gustman gave his Talmud class, Vilna was once alive and vibrant. One of the regular participants was Yisrael Amen, who some of you may know, won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2005, shown on the left. When Israel mobilized its reserve officers for Operation Peace for Galilee, it included Professor Amon's 25-year-old son, Shlomo. Shlomo was killed in a fierce battle on the eve of the 19th of the Hebrew month of Sivan. Rav Gustman mobilized all of his students to perform the godly deed of burying the dead. At the cemetery, though, he became very agitated. He looked at the graves of young men, the soldiers who died defending the land of Israel. On the way back from the cemetery, Rav Gustman said, "They are all holy. Every Jew who is killed simply because he is a Jew or defending the Jewish people goes to a special place in heaven." He then told his driver, "Take me to Professor Amon's home." The Amons had just returned from the cemetery and were mourning. Shlomo had been married and had one child, and his wife was expecting their second. She gave birth to their daughter shortly after his death. Rav Gussman asked to sit next to Professor Amen, who said, "Rabbi, I so appreciate your coming, but you really belong back in the yeshiva." Rav Gussman spoke so that everyone would hear him. "I had a beautiful child named Meir. He was taken from my arms by the Nazis and executed. I escaped. I later bartered my son's shoes so that we would have food, but I was never able to eat the food. I gave it to others. My Meir is holy, and so are all of the 6 million who perished. I will tell you what is transpiring now in the world of truth. My Meir is welcoming your Shlomo in the minyan, and is saying to him, 'I died because I was a Jew, but I wasn't able to save anybody else. But you, Shlomo, you died defending the Jewish people in the land of Israel. My Meir is holy, but your son Shlomo is a Shaliach Tzibor, a representative of the congregation in that holy heavenly minyan. I never had the opportunity to sit Shiva for my Meir. Let me sit here with you just a little longer.' Professor Amen replied, 'I thought I could never be comforted, but Rebbe, you have comforted me.'" Rav Gussman passed away on the 18th of Sivan in the year 1991. As night fell on the 19th of Sivan, exactly 9 years from the moment that Shlomo Amen fell in battle, Rav Gussman was buried. I'm sure that upon entering heaven, he was reunited with his wife, his teachers, and his beloved mayor. I am also sure that Shlomo and all the other holy soldiers who died defending the people in the land of Israel were there to greet him. We now come to the large memorial for the victims of acts of terror. The inscription here is from the book of Jeremiah that says, "Rachel mevaka al baneha me'ana lehinachem." Our mother Rachel is crying for her children. She refuses to be comforted. The memorial begins with the first Jew murdered by an Arab in 1860 when the Jews left the old city of Jerusalem, and continues a seemingly endless parade until the present. The thousands of names here are overwhelming. They are victims of the Arab riots of 1920, 1921, the Hebron massacre of 1929, the Arab revolt of 1936-39, the war of survival that began right after the UN voted that Jews should have a state in Palestine in 1947, and continues to this day. We see the names of victims of Fatah that created a charter in 1964 to violently destroy Israel. At the same time, Jordan controlled East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and Egypt controlled Gaza. All the Jews in Palestine were living inside the Green Line. Fatah guerrillas started killing Jews in Israel in January of 1965. In 69, when Arafat took over as leader of Fatah, they made 2,432 attacks against Israelis in just 1 year. Even though Israeli prime ministers treat them as peace partners, they have never renounced their terrorism against Israel. In September of 1970, King Hussein of Jordan killed thousands of Palestinians who tried to set up their own state inside Jordan and flouted his authority in Jordanian law. After the PLO signed agreements with the Jordanian government to renounce violence and submit to Jordanian law, Fatah repeatedly abrogated the agreements. By the end of 71, Hussein had routed the PLO from Jordan. The Palestinians led by Arafat were expelled to Lebanon, where they started a civil war that resulted in thousands of more Arab deaths. This war led to Operation Peace for Galilee. The Lebanese expelled Fatah and Arafat, and they went to various countries and reestablished their terror network in Tunisia, from where they continued their terrorism against Jews in Europe and the Middle East, and they trained other groups to conduct terror. In 1992, Rabin resurrected Arafat and Fatah and moved them back to Israel. Although the Oslo Accords required the PLO to recognize Israel and renounce violence in their charter, they never did either. The first Arab Intifada, or uprising, began in December of 1987. 90 Israelis were killed by Arabs between 87 and the signing of the Oslo Accords in 93. Since the Accords, Israel honored its agreement to give land and weapons to the Palestinian Authority. Israeli leaders allowed the Arabs to violate the agreements with impunity, deterred by concerns that other countries would not like what they were doing, and critiques about continuing the cycle of violence. In an effort to deflect public focus from his own misdeeds, Arik Sharon also expelled 10,000 Jews from their lawfully established communities in 2005. These acts were supposed to advance the peace process. Instead, Arab terrorists from Fatah and Hamas and other groups saw Israel's policies of restraint, withdrawal, and unwillingness to insist that the PLO live up to their agreement as a sign of Israeli incompetence and weakness. They have murdered more than 1,250 Israelis, mostly civilians, since Oslo. Most of these occurred during the Second Intifada that went from September 2000 to 2004. To describe each horrific bus, mall, and restaurant bombing and roadside shootings would take days. You can see the terrorists here from the Israelis and what a menace they were to the Arabs that these people had to be done in. And these are just a very small fraction of some of the victims. I will tell you about three different families, though. These are people who were named in the plaque of terrorism for sparrows and other terror victims. Any of you know the Sparrow Pizzeria? It's a very busy intersection in Jerusalem, probably the most busiest on the corner of King George Street and Jaffa Street. In August 9, 2001, a suicide bomber detonated his belt with 15 to 20 pounds of explosives, nails, nuts, and bolts to inflict maximal damage on children and women during lunch hour in this crowded restaurant. He killed 8 adults and 7 children and wounded 130 people. Several families were almost completely wiped out. One father was heard telling his 5-year-old son, "Say Shema Yisrael with me before we die." On September 15th, 2003, Dr. David Applebaum went to Cafe Hillel with his beautiful 20-year-old daughter, Nava. David Applebaum had made Aliyah with his wife from New York a number of years before. He's a gentle father of 6 children, and he had set up special emergency services at Bikur Cholim Hospital due to the numerous terror attacks that were taking place nearby. Went out for a quiet night of special dad-daughter bonding before her wedding, and a suicide bomber walked into Cafe Hillel and blew the place up. David himself was one of the victims. He and his daughter were buried on her wedding day. As they buried her, her fiancé dropped the wedding ring into the grave with his beloved. Her wedding gown is now a curtain that covers the ark in the synagogue at the grave of her mother Rachel near Bethlehem. These are the 8 amazing boys who were killed in cold blood as they studied in Merkaz HaRav Kook in Jerusalem in March of 2008. They were studying Torah when a terrorist came inside the yeshiva and started shooting recklessly at them. One of these boys was from Ethiopia. He had little Jewish knowledge. He's the one on the lower right. He had little Jewish knowledge and begged to be admitted to the school. In order to catch up, he offered to work in the kitchen for 2 years until his skills were on par with those of the boys in the other yeshiva. This sweet angelic boy was gunned down with the others. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank celebrated with parties. The list of names goes on and on. The War of Independence has not ended. It has just changed form. Now going to another part of the cemetery where we have British victims. These are graves of people who the British hung and who also fought in Neeli. The woman on the right is Sarah Aronson. Sarah went to Turkey in 1916 and saw the Armenian genocide by the Turks. And she believed that if the world could stand by and watch this happen and not say a word, that the Jews would be next. So she and some family members and Avshalom Feinberg decided to give the British information about what the Turks were doing, where they were moving, how many forces they had in Israel, so that when the British came in World War I, they would be able to defeat the Turks. And somebody asked one of the British commanders how in the world Allenby had such an easy time conquering such a difficult place. He said that the information from Neeli is what allowed him to do so. This is Yosef Leshansky, one of the other members of Neeli. I'm going to race through a little bit now. These were 2 men who were who assassinated Lord Moyne, and they were hung by the British for doing so. The reason behind it was, according to Joel Brand, Lord Moyne was offered Eichmann's deal to gain the release of 1 million Jews in exchange for 10,000 trucks. According to him, Moyne retorted, "What would I do with 1 million Jews? Where would I put them?" Over the next 4 months, 437,000 Hungarian Jews were gassed at Auschwitz. At his trial, the 20-year-old Eliyahu Hakim said, "We accuse Lord Moyne and the government he represents with murdering hundreds and thousands of her brethren." The 23-year-old Beth Zuri said, "Millions sank in the sea of blood and tears, but the British skippers did not lift them to the ship. And if a few of the survivors who tried to come to Palestine during those years actually made it, the British skipper pushed them back into the sea, and we had no choice but to surrender or fight. We chose to fight. When Hakim was about to be hung, the British would hang the prisoners in red burlap suits. He looked down at his clothing and said, "This is the finest suit of clothes I have ever worn in my life." And he and Bet Zuri sang Hatikva as they were sent to the gallows. This is Lord Moyne. We now go to the Gush Etzion plot. I'm getting close to time, Pam. How much time do I have left?
I think we have 10 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
So in 1947, when the Arabs besieged Jerusalem, they also attacked and besieged the community called Gush Etzion, a small community of about 400 Jews that was south of Jerusalem. They knew if they could defeat Gush Etzion, they had a clear way to get to Jerusalem and besiege and conquer the city. The Jews there fought tremendously, courageously. In the end, the Jordanians came, they rounded up the Jews who were left. I think there were 153 Jews who were left there. They asked them to come on a little hilltop to take a picture before they took them into captivity. As the Jews laid down all their weapons, the Arabs had them lining up on the hilltop, and they gunned them all down. I think out of the entire 153, only two or four escaped. I think four escaped. So this is the plot of Gush Etzion. The gravestones will tell you that almost all of these people died on the same day. Before the Gush Etzion thing happened, Gush Etzion fell exactly when Ben-Gurion was announcing the State of Israel. The other story that went along with the Gush Etzion happened a few months earlier. There was a siege of the Arabs on Gush Etzion. There were 35 very brave men who decided to go and try to relieve the siege. They went on foot, led by Danny Moss. And these people were called the Lamed He, standing for Lamed is 30 in Hebrew, He is 5. There were 35 men who went. Today is the 61st anniversary of this little journey that these Jews tried to make to relieve the siege of Gush Etzion. The two different versions of the story, one of the versions is they found an old Arab and they decided not to kill him. As they were trying to go in the stealth of night to relieve the siege, the Arab went to the neighboring village, all the Arab men came out and they murdered all these men and tortured them and viciously destroyed the bodies so badly that 12 of the 35 could not be identified. Famous story, man named Rabbi Arya Levine, who using what's called the lottery of the Vilna Gaon, was able to take a Jewish Bible, and by turning it in certain ways and doing all kinds of mystical things, he was able to identify exactly which boy went with which body. And if anybody wants more details about it, it's written up in a book called about Rabbi Arya Levine called The Tzaddik in Our Time. Very, very interesting story and an amazing man. Here's Rabbi Arya Levine. This is the Ethiopian memorial that we see as we walk towards the exit. There were 4,000 Ethiopian Jews who died leaving Ethiopia for Sudan on foot. You know the story of the airlift. In 1984, the Israelis tried to airlift Jews from Ethiopia. They had to go to Sudan. They were taken out. Thanks to the press, they insisted on blowing open the story. Thousands of Jews were trapped behind in Ethiopia for the next 7 years before they were allowed to leave. Today, Israel has about 100,000 Ethiopian Jews. This is the memorial to the Jewish Quarter. In 1948, the Jewish Quarter was besieged, and in May of 1948, when the British left, the Jordanians came in with tanks. There were 1,700 people in the old city. Of those, less than 200 even knew how to operate a weapon. Less than 200 of them could operate because they didn't have any weapons. And this is the memorial to the 67 Jews who were killed by the Jordanians when they came into the old city. When the Jordanians came, they blew up every single one of the 54 synagogues that was in the old city, except for one. They somehow missed that one, because they were trying to make sure the Jews would never come back to Jerusalem. This is a memorial to Nissim Gini, 9 years, 10 months old. He was a runner between houses. They had no phones in the old city. He was giving messages, and he was caught in gunfire, and he died of his wounds. Okay, we're going to skip the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War. You can see a woman tending to the grave of her son. Just 1 second. The plot for the Yom Kippur War has 300 people in it. The battalion has more than 300 people. Over 2,000 soldiers were killed in the Yom Kippur War. It was the worst battle that the Jews had been in, except for the War of Independence. Dado Elazar was blamed for the war. He died of heartbreak in his 40s, and he's buried there. He was not responsible for the war. He actually wanted the reservists to be called up. And we have Yoni Netanyahu, who I'm sure many of you know about. I don't think I need to go back into Yoni's story. But the bottom line was that Yoni was an officer. He had the choice to go to Harvard. He came back to Israel to serve in the elite forces in Israel. By the way, Bibi, his brother, and another brother were all in the armed services at the same time. When a jet was hijacked to Entebbe under Idi Amin, he made this unbelievable plan to rescue the Jews who were hijacked and held hostage in Entebbe. And unfortunately for Yoni, he was the only one who was killed. It was a wonderful rescue mission, but he did not survive, and he is laid to rest in a Herzl. You may be surprised to know that in World War II, there were 500,000 European Jewish soldiers. We far overrepresented our proportion of the population fighting in World War II. There were 150,000 Jews, 200,000 died. There were 150,000 Jews from Poland alone who died in World War II. This is Roy Klein and his wife. Roy was in the Second Lebanese War. He was one of the first people to die. There was a grenade thrown at his men. He jumped on top of it saying Shema Yisrael. And he was blown up to save the men he was with, and he made sure as he was dying to give away his, he had some kind of coding device that he made sure to give to his men before he died so that the Arabs would not be able to get a hold of it. On a more optimistic note, you all know about Michael Levin from Philadelphia? Yeah? Very briefly, Michael was 16, he went to Camp Ramah, he got inspired to live as a Jew in Israel. He was 19, he came to Israel to join the paratroopers, who noticed little wings over his pocket. Michael was about 5'4" and weighed 118 pounds, and he was so little that when he tried to jump from the plane, the wind blew him off course. So they had to put special weights on him so that he could be a paratrooper. So after he finished his mission, he got his wings, and this is a picture of him. He was very, very small. That's him with his father. And he finished his training. He was in an elite paratrooper unit. He went back to the United States to spend time with his family. His twin sister was at a party with him. He found out about the war in Lebanon, and he left to go back to Israel where he was killed. I'm just going to tell one last story of something a little more optimistic to end on a happy note. I won't be able to finish the rest of the pictures here. Here's Michael's grave. This is a place for all the birthright students to come. They leave baseball caps and all kinds of memorabilia there. That's Uri Grossman, the son of David Grossman, who was killed in the Second Lebanon War. I'm going to end with the story of Rabbi Grossman. During the Second Lebanon War, there was a brigade of 600 soldiers who had fought. You may know that in the Second Lebanon War, people went in, the Israeli government did not give them water, didn't give them food, didn't give them bulletproof vests, didn't give them night vision goggles. They were completely ill-equipped. There was no plan. The head of the Ministry of Defense was not a military man. So these men went in to fight, and it was a very, very difficult situation. So after starving for 2 weeks, there was a group of 600 soldiers who were given a day off. And they found out, much to their chagrin, that they were going to be sent to a yeshiva. Can you imagine your day off to go to a yeshiva? So they were really dreading this. And the person who was in charge of the yeshiva is Rabbi Yitzchak Davi Grossman. And this is a town in northern Israel that had a school, but the whole area had been evacuated due to the war. So he said, I'll offer my campus for these soldiers. So they come, they get off the bus, they see this guy. The first thought is, oh my goodness, he's going to tell us to pray. So his first words to these soldiers are, everybody to the swimming pool. So the 600 soldiers who haven't changed their clothes in 2 weeks, you can imagine what they feel like, what they smell like, what they look like. They go to the swimming pool. Meanwhile, Rabbi Grossman has a spread of food put out for them, the first real food they've eaten in weeks. And at dinner that night, he says, every person who needs something, have a piece of paper and a pencil in front of you on the table. Please write down what you need. These soldiers couldn't believe it. They also found that there was clean underwear for them. There were clean packages of all kinds of things that they needed, necessities. The next day when they woke up, Rabbi Grossman had bought $60,000 worth of supplies, and whatever they needed was sitting there in front of them before they went back to war. Rabbi Grossman had been asked by a French Jew to have a dedication of a Torah scroll at his place, and he had, for whatever reason, delayed it, and that day he decided to dedicate the Sefer Torah, this Torah scroll. Every single soldier had a chance to write one of the letters and to finish up the scroll. And these are really totally secular soldiers. Many had never seen a Torah scroll in their entire life. And they were so moved by this ceremony, Rabbi Grossman had them put on tefillin. They all said a prayer together. He gave each one of them a half shekel, which is worth about 10 cents. Gave them a hug, gave them a blessing, and said, when you come back perfectly safe from this war, first thing you do before you go home is you come to me and you're going to give this half a shekel to charity. So he sends them all off with a big hug and a kiss, and they go off to war. And a few weeks later, he gets a phone call from the commander. It's been a miracle. 600 soldiers, everybody has come back healthy and intact. They had a very big celebratory party at Migdal Or. Anyway, that is the story.
What town was that in?
It's called Migdal HaEmek.
Oh.
Migdal HaEmek. So, do I have one more minute?
Sure.
Okay. The day I was there, I was standing at this grave, and it was the ultimate sight. These graves actually have pictures on them, and so instead of people being just numbers or casualty figures in the newspaper, you actually see what these wonderful men, who are really boys, look like. They're mostly 20, 21 years old, some are younger. His father came, he lit the little yardside candle in the box next to it, and he kissed his son's grave. And you realize when you see these people coming, and they're real people, they look real, it could be any one of our sons, it could be any one of our brothers. And we realize the tremendous sacrifices that these men are making for us all the time. I'm going to end with a little short story. This is the grave of the first soldier who fell in the Gaza War. When I went to take pictures, he happened to have just been buried, and there's his fresh grave. And some of you may know Arthur Miller's play, All My Sons. So it tells the story of an American businessman who deliberately falsifies aircraft building materials and risks the lives of American soldiers to make larger profits. The final scene, the businessman pathetically defends himself by saying that his own sons were not in those planes. The prosecuting attorney charges, they were all our sons. People who lie in Mount Herzl are indeed all our sons and daughters. It matters not if one is religious or secular, leftist or right-wing, Sephardic or Ashkenazic. The one thing that unites us most, unfortunately, is when we face a common enemy. We have a shared crisis or a devastating loss. It's my hope that we Jews will see the importance of our uniting as a Jewish people and to support the people who are fighting on our behalf to keep the land of Israel safe for us Jews. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Aiken, for quite a remarkable presentation, and thank you for the effort that you put into research and to provide such an interesting PowerPoint presentation. Just watching this reminded me of my visit to Mount Herzl Cemetery 2 summers ago when I co-led a birthright trip, and Major Roy Klein, who is buried there, was one of the graves that we visited. I'm sure almost all of you have been to Israel, and many of you may have not gone to Mount Herzl. I want to thank Dr. Aiken for opening our eyes, and I'm sure many of us who will go back to Israel will visit Mount Herzl with a different perspective now. But again, on a more positive note, a group of our students just came back from Israel and were there during the Gaza War. And there is a battle that is going on all the time in Israel, almost throughout our history. But there's a battle that's going on college campuses as well, and that's what JET is doing. And we really appreciate each and every one of you coming here today and telling other people about what JET is doing, because there are so many Jewish students who are unaware of our history, are unaware of the sacrifice that so many people have made so that they can have a homeland, they can have a place that they can go to, and they can go visit. Hundreds of thousands of Jewish students have visited Israel, not only on birthright programs, but on all kinds of programs. They are able to sit and learn and do all kinds of things in Israel because of the sacrifices these people have made. But unfortunately, so many Jewish students have got no idea about it. So, I mean, we've heard many people here today who belong to many different organizations are doing great work. We believe that JET is doing very, very important work on college campuses, and I appreciate your support, and I appreciate you coming. Again, please take a copy of one of these magazines and take a look at some of the books that Dr. Aiken has written. I've now seen a different side of Dr. Aiken. She's spoken on many different topics, and I highly recommend her books. Thank you again. I hope to see you all on Wednesday, February the 18th. We will let you know where it's going to be exactly. but we thank again Harold Kaplan for hosting.
I just want to say one thing too, based on the talk that we just had, and that Lisa mentioned that